Welcome back to Emerge. So it's been a little while. Last time I released an episode was about, going on 4 months now. Nearly three of the months that have gone by I spent in silent retreat here at the Monastic Academy. And the month following that, since I've gotten out, has been its own kind of strange experience. There was a New York Times article written about me and my retreat and coming out into a post-COVID world. And subsequent to that, it was covered in newspapers, radio shows, TV shows all over the world, doing interviews and for Australian and Irish and British newspapers and radio shows in Canada, New Zealand, so on. I went viral on Chinese TikTok. It's a strange experience, one that I described to a friend as a kind of metamodern fever dream, coming out of an intensive silent retreat into going viral across this strange noosphere. And frankly, I left the retreat more ambivalent than ever before about this project and about media in general, about creating more information. You know, there's a quote, I don't remember who said it or where I heard it, but something like, if information were the solution, we'd all have a six-figure bank account and washboard abs. The problem is not a lack of content. To put it another way, if information were the solution, we'd probably all be behaving in ways, at least those of us who are drawn to projects like this, we'd all be behaving in ways that are aligned with the well-being of all. And yet, for me, it's unclear that the conversations that I've had on this show are actually onward leading in any meaningful way. Now, of course, they do good work in terms of inspiring people, connecting this network that, due to this podcast and many others over the last few years, has begun to discover itself and thus open the doors to new forms of collaboration, sense making, and action. That's really exciting, but it's an open question for me whether you really need to have this kind of conversation, this sort of medium, once that's occurred. Indeed, you can listen to earlier episodes where I struggle with the fact that this medium, this podcast format, where I'm typically speaking to a quote-unquote expert, and then you, the listener, are listening to, I've gotten so much value out of that format, or at least I think I have. But at the same time, it is reifying a kind of disempowered relationship to the world. You are the listener. You're the consumer. You are passively, more or less passively, taking in what I and the guests say. It's quite clear to me that, or one way that I tend to understand the deep shift that's needed in the world today, is that we move from a sense of ourselves as consumers or objective observers into understanding ourselves to be participants, radical participants, that the nature of the world, the nature of perception, the nature of the social world, the nature of all the domains of our life is somehow fundamentally participatory. Now, this is what I spent 75 days of intensive retreat exploring. How is it that I unwittingly participate in my own suffering? And how is it that I can participate in a different way that liberates me from the suffering? Or in the case of Rob Brebea's soul-making dharma, which I had the opportunity to spend a lot of time practicing, how is it that I can participate to sacralize, to divinize, to make beautiful my perception, to make beautiful the world and my life and my experience, my relationships with the trees, with the animals, with the folks in my community? And so much, in my view, hangs on this question of participation. Do we understand that we're participating? And even that can be a long journey to realize ourselves as participants, and then to further develop the skills to participate skillfully in those domains which are most meaningful, to wrest away this identity as consumers or passive observers of the world. This is not easy. Our culture is really built to a large degree in all kinds of obvious and all kinds of subtle ways on encouraging us to take on this way of seeing our lives as consumers, as observers, as powerless. And so I wonder, I'm curious, to what degree is the medium the message here? To what degree is it the case that merely by virtue of creating static content for you to listen to, am I amplifying that identity of consumer observer? So I don't know. I don't know how this lands with you, but it feels very up for me. And you'll see this struggle, this tension, this inquiry woven into my conversation with Zach Stein. We talk about what it means to make the arena of your participation something like Facebook. Frankly, I think Zach makes a strong case that it's more or less impossible to use Facebook in a way that's truly in service of my value of showing up in the world in a way that I can feel proud of. And so for me, coming out of retreat, a big question is, what arenas, what domains, what patterns do I want to feed with my life, my energy? And it's very clear that feeding and taking care of those around me, those closest to me, those in my community, my family, my friends, is the most important thing. And as you'll hear in this conversation with Zach, I experience there to be a tension between participating in this, what he calls meta-narrative online space, and really caring for those around me. I don't know what's going to happen to this project. In a big way, and I said this before, it feels like some process has been completed, some circuit has been completed. The way I understand it is that the network has discovered itself. The network has become self-aware. And so we're moving into a new phase of this experiment. My hope is that we're going from this initial discovery phase into some kind of more coherent collaboration and collective sovereignty, that some kind of what Jordan Hall calls a self-organizing collective intelligence is emerging. And I hope that I can play some small role in supporting that collective intelligence in becoming more sovereign and in orienting to the world in a way that it can really make a difference. And above all, I feel a deep commitment to at least trying to be more ruthless when it comes to the conversations, the information that I share, that they are in service of love, and that they aren't just or merely a distraction from that which matters most. And so you'll hear in that a theme from all the episodes that I've done so far, many of the episodes, which is struggling to know when it is appropriate to think, try to understand, and to use the conceptual mind, to use concepts. And when is that just bullshit? Our world is addicted to concepts. Our world is addicted to ideas and to thinking. Living in a monastery that's informed by Zen practice is increasing my suspicion, my caution around the world of concepts and ideas. And I think that's right. I think if you're in a position of creating information, of adding more information to the world right now, and you don't have this sense of caution or suspicion, I'd be concerned. I'd be suspicious of you. Because again, it should be very clear by this point that it's not more information that's going to save us, that's going to be what makes a difference. And that insight right there, that there's not more information, there's not some information out there, there's not some conversation you can listen to, there's not some insight that somebody can render into language and share with you that's going to finally do it. It's essential that those of us who really care about the world and care about living a virtuous life have that insight, realize that. Otherwise, we'll be looking in the wrong place for what really matters. So if you can take a moment right now to choose between listening to this conversation that I think is beautiful, this conversation you're about to listen to, perhaps with Zach Stein. But if you're in a situation where right now you can choose that instead of listening to this conversation, you can express to someone in your life, to someone nearby, that you love them, that you care about them, or that you can have a difficult conversation with somebody in your life. Have a conversation that, if you navigate through, will lead to more connection, more love in the world. I'm going to invite you to stop this podcast and go do that. That would be a better use of your time. If that's not an option, or that's not the choice you want to make right now, that's fine. But it feels important to me to be honest about what really matters and what makes a difference. And hopefully that will support you in being honest about your choice making. So that's a long intro for this podcast. And I welcome questions or feedback about what I've shared. As always, if you have guests that you believe I should talk to, the best place to reach me is on Twitter, @dthorson. You can also email me at dthorson@gmail.com. And I do get a lot of, enough emails that it can be hard for me to respond, especially given the schedule here at the Monastic Academy. And so this, I want to say to you, really appreciate anything you want to share with me. And it might be some time before I am able to respond, and when I do respond, it might not be as robust and lengthy a response as I would like to give, but I still really care. I love hearing from you, people who listen to this podcast. It means a lot to me. And the last thing I want to share is about an event that we're hosting here at the Monastic Academy. We're going to be doing another bioemotive emotional processing retreat, this time from September 18th to 25th. So this retreat is led by previous guest of the show, Dr. Doug Tatarin. And if you don't know, the bioemotive framework is an incredibly effective method of learning to work with and resolve emotional blockages and freeing up life energy. So in this retreat, we get to learn the whole protocol from soup to nuts, you know, both the conceptual framework as well as the various practices. And then we get to use it in the context of the Monastic Academy community, in the context of a loving and safe container. We get to do that in dyads and small groups. And then we also use it to deepen our relationships, bringing this bioemotive approach into we space practices like circling. And so if you want to learn more about bioemotive, you can listen to my episode with Doug Tatarin. It's called Emotions in Meditation and Human Development. And if you want to learn more about the event, you can go to www.monasticacademy.org/events. Be really great to have you join us. Of course, all of this is dependent on the situation with the pandemic. And so there is a full refund available if we decide or determine that it's best to cancel the event. Okay, so without further ado, please enjoy this episode of Emerge with Zach Stein. So maybe I'll kind of explore a little bit out loud why I wanted to speak with you. And
great.
I don't have like many designs on this conversation.
Good. Me neither.
Yeah. So by way of context, you know, I just sat a 75-day retreat and emerged into this world that people tell me has changed a lot. And as I'm reading and kind of syncing back up with the collective, and I'm seeing the many ways in which that's the case. And I do feel
disoriented, I think, leaving the retreat, especially in the way that I did, where suddenly there was a lot of attention on me. And have been thinking, like, okay, well then, who should I talk to kind of either orient or get more disoriented or whatever it is that actually wants to happen here? And something that seemed really ideal would be if I could meet somebody in person, because it seems like many, if not all, the conversations that are happening right now are actually happening not in person. And so I thought, well, Zach, you know, now lives about an hour away, and we could meet in person. And I also read your article, There's a War in Heaven, and was moved by that. Like, it certainly accorded with a lot of how I tend to orient, I think, partly because you've previously shared your perspective, so I'm kind of pre-programmed to look that way. But I guess I'm wanting help both for me and then perhaps for listeners, although maybe they don't have this, they aren't in the same situation I'm in, to make sense out of what's happening and how to relate to it. I mean, as we're speaking now, we are 3 months into a global pandemic, which isn't over. In fact, there's more infections now, I think, in the US at least, than there have been for a long time. And yet that story is receding as the focus on civil unrest and protests comes to the fore. And I notice, for me, it's coming out of retreat, that there's like, it'd be very easy to kind of just lose myself again in the day-to-day of what's arising and the information that's coming at me. And then there's also a kind of desire to disconnect, to almost ignore what's happening and really focus on those that are around me, my community at the Monastic Academy, the projects I'm working on, and to, you know, actually be a bit more of a secluded monastic, as that is like an affordance that's available to me. And so all that is kind of playing out in my world, and I imagine for others too. And so, yeah, that's kind of why I wanted to speak with you, is just to help sort of orient in this disorienting world. I'm curious if there's anything that arises for you, or if there's something you want
to... No, I mean, you know, the Rip Van Winkle thing was interesting because it sets a mythic tone. And of course, Rip Van Winkle fell asleep before the American Revolution and woke up after the American Revolution. And it's important to think about, you know, what's knowable, what's unknown but knowable, and then what's simply unknowable. And we're in the middle of something as a species right now. And there are dimensions of it that are probably unknown, but that we can figure out. And then there are dimensions of it that are, I think, in the realm of just simply unknowable, especially at this moment in time. When something this big is unfolding, it is very difficult to know exactly what it is. So the idea that the pandemic and the protests and then the election, that these are all part of some larger process or pattern that's unfolding, it's not a conspiracy theory to say that. It's actually a factual look at the nature of the causal events. And so that's the kind of first kind of volley on my part, is that as much as we need to make sense of what's happening, we also know, we have to know that there are patterns that are unfolding, as there have always been in history, that are beyond the comprehension, literally, of those people who are living within them. And so the idea that, well, then one should fall back into the things that are for sure, like the the relationships with the people I care about, and the things that keep me sane and acting with integrity. That's a completely reasonable reaction. That's not necessarily escapist,
right?
Because the idea that you could go out and figure out what's actually happening,
and
frantically do that, and then take take clear action based on obvious, how are you going to do if what you need to orient is knowledge of exactly what's unfolding, then you will lock that in obviously prematurely and begin to potentially do more damage than good. So one of the things most surprising about the informational ecosystem to me is the confidence with which people are speaking about things, which are, I think, demonstrably uncertain. And so I think that's the first thing is I would love to orient you, and I'll try. But there's also a part where it's like we need to be able to rest in a little bit of unknowing, which is, of course, in a sense, what you were prepared to do with the retreat.
Well, it's been really a fascinating experience to interface with the news companies and radio shows and TV shows who've been interviewing me, because one, they all ask me, what do you think of what's happening? And of course, my true answer is, I just came out of 75 days of silence. I have no idea
what's happening. Not that point.
Yeah. And it's going to take me a while to even begin to answer that question. But if I ever, when I say that, that never makes it into the story. My hesitancy, my deferment of taking a single perspective never ends up in the story. And I imagine that's working itself out in every case that somebody tries not to solidify or reify into a position.
Yeah, and that's incredibly problematic from kind of a sense-making perspective and a sanity perspective, because there's a certain duplicity with which people are engaging the informational ecosystem. We're kind of like in the privacy of their own minds, and perhaps in some very intimate conversations with very trusted folks, they will speak to the ambiguities. They will feel into the fact that they don't know and feel the frustration and difficulty and anxiety of not knowing. They'll see more nuance in their political positions. But when publicly facing through social media and other outlets, there will be zero ambiguity, complete sense of righteousness. And so that duplicity is very hard to hold. And for people who are, especially younger people, who are not sophisticated enough to know their minds, to know that there's duplicity, and I think you're in a situation where there's a deep, deep mistrust just all around, because there's a sense that we can't be this certain about this on either side. The conspiracy theorists are very, very certain. And then the mainstream news is also very, very certain. And then the left is certain and the right is certain. And who's saying, I'm not totally sure. Let's slow down and collaborate to think about what's actually happening on the first premise that we don't exactly know what's happening. And so that's, that's remarkable that happened, and I'm not surprised that happened with the news. And as an educator, it's kind of ghastly, because it's the most antithetical thing to cultivating states of sincere curiosity.
And so
I think that's good to put your finger on that first when you're kind of wading in, is that you actually have to take it, all of it, with a grain of salt. And then figure out what other spices are actually on the table and what's needed. Do you need to know to live?
Yeah, and so I think what occurs to me as I listen to you is that this is actually a really great opportunity to go quite slowly here. Because over the last 2 weeks, I've been watching my conceptual world being rebuilt out of the wake of the silence I was in. I'm like, oh yeah, metamodernism, that's a thing, I guess, that I participate with, existential risk. Okay, that's, that's a problem. And on and on and on. It's kind of being rebooted, it feels like. And so I think it'd be interesting to just sort of I find myself in this state of really not knowing how to interface with the world in a way that's trustworthy or skillful. And I recognize what you said, that there's skill and integrity in that deferment of collapsing into a perspective, but there's also impotence if you prolong that deferment too long. And so, and I imagine that a lot of listeners are probably also in this kind of state where they're like, everything seems untrustworthy. Wah. So then what do you do then?
Well, this, hanging back, what do you need to know to live? Like, you know, there's a great deal that we do know, and a lot of stuff that we are certain about. Now, most of that doesn't have anything to do with epidemiology and geopolitical machinations and alternative warfare and the deep state and alien. Like, no, that stuff will remain in the realm of it's unknown, but we could know it, or there's lots of uncertainties, probabilities, right? Yeah. But things like love, my wife, or people deserve respect. Like, there are things which are not a retreat from sense-making. If we confuse sense-making with somehow telling a meta-narrative about the geopolitical and evolutionary situation of mankind, and then we need to get that correct before we can take any next steps, we're screwed, right? So we need to have these different kind of layers or levels of certainty, different realms of certainty. And it's important to stay grounded in those things that we do know we can be certain about, that allow us to act with integrity. And like that you live in a monastic community that allows you guys to actually do this, right? Now, if your job is you are a politician or you are a journalist, right, or you're a medical doctor or other things, or you're someone who's more like public intellectually, then there are things that expand your kind of circle of influence, and that means that you need to take more epistemological responsibility for more. But even then, those folks need to actually ground all of that back in the life world of their lived experience, because precisely by getting seduced by some complex meta-narrative about the geopolitical situation, you could come to actually treat the people closest to you like shit. Because you're seduced that there's some more important story that's unfolding. And that story may actually undermine the idea that all people require respect and dignity, right? And so that's, I think, always been one of the functions of ideology in the capitalist world system, is actually to like act back down upon and invade the life world and make it difficult for us to work as kind of a species and force us into retreating into like balkanizations and these days identity politics, which are always predicated upon a much, much, much more complex story than the obvious kind of like, as we call it, the Center for Integral Wisdom, the anthro-ontological common sense, right? Which is the kind of common core of a lot of the ethical precepts from all the religious traditions, kind of neo-perennialist view about what's the core of those orientations in the life world. Which should be the core of education and the things that we focus on. So yeah, so that's one thing, is like orient to at least those two realms of sense making. You know, there's the life world that's given to us in which we all reside, and it's mediated by everyday language and a whole bunch of other things with our affective systems and interpersonal systems. And then there's this realm of meta-narrative and complexity, which is important. I'm not saying that's not important, and I'm not saying that couldn't be drastically, drastically improved, and I'm not saying that there aren't actually more or less true, like there are, in fact, and there are things to say about that. But that's secondary and should not become a distraction, let alone something that disrupts that first, more primary core of kind of anthro-ontological certainty, which is available. Yeah, so that's one way that I approach it.
Yeah, and it's I so appreciate that perspective, because as I came out of retreat, I had tremendous certainty, and I still do, of the importance of the relationships I have with those around me. Yeah. And in fact, like, I saw that the most important thing was that I found a way to love the people I was with.
Right.
Like, before and above everything else.
Yeah.
And then I entered into this whole world of abstract meta-narratives again. And I noticed the way in which that began to destabilize and alienate me from my community. And that created tension whereby at one point, actually a couple of days ago, I was like, I'm actually just going to exit from participation in this. Like, you know, I'm not a public intellectual, but in a way I'm like a public intellectual. I'm close. I could move in that direction more and more.
Right.
And I'm just like, oh, is the cost of doing that, that I'm going to be able to be less connected with the physical world and the people around me that I love? Well, I don't know if that's a good a good deal. And so I appreciate you, like, you're just naming that. Like, I'm living that exact tension. And I imagine a lot of folks are in their own ways when social media kind of like gets in the way of them being able to be there with their loved ones.
Yeah, totally. And you have to think about,
we're all public intellectuals right now.
We are. We're all, that's one of the issues. Yeah, we're all public intellectuals. And there's a way in which it's like, and, you know, the first time we spoke a lot about death.
Yeah.
And, you know, on your deathbed, you're not going to be like, oh, I really wish if I'd figured out if there were those lizard aliens. You know, you're not going to on your deathbed be like, what were the facts about the epidemiology? You're like, no, you're going to be like, I wish I'd spent more time with the people I love. Right. And this is universally the case. And so you just have to get some perspective. And the social media is actually, that's the like techno infrastructural core of the issue.
Mm.
It's kind of preying upon certain psychological vulnerabilities we have to privilege ideology over the givens of the life world. And that's been the case again. It's a pattern in human history, but there's a generator now, a kind of engine for that, which is way, way, way more devious and insidious. And is, forcing us basically to override our common sense in the interest of ideological causes. Mm-hmm. And that's not a good sign. The idea of stepping back from that, which I've done, I'm not on any social media, never look at that stuff.
Yeah.
That's part of it, because it was just the opposite of decency. It was just a breakdown of these things, which I thought were actually the core of the potential of the human, is in these anthro-ontological givens, which we can feel when we're attuned to them.
Yes.
And like you said, which you felt when you came out of retreat, you know, that sense. Yes. But under duress, under certain kinds of developmental pressures, growing up and other things, that given sense, which can be refined and developed, it's not just there. It's not like a retro-romantic given. Right. It's a muscle that can be exercised. Yeah. If it's not, then you can lose touch. And then you're guided by simulation. You're not guided by reality.
Yeah.
And then that's the thing that also allows you to have uncertainty about that other layer of meta-narrative, right? If you have certainty about these core dynamics and you can rest in them, then you can actually kind of sit there and look out at the meta narrative and be like, okay, this is uncertain. There's a ton of uncertainty here, but that's okay, because my identity is not completely dependent upon projecting commitment to one of these meta narratives. My identity is dependent upon these relationships I have in my life.
Yeah. Right?
But as soon as your identity, self-esteem regulation, self-esteem regulation, kind of like self-sense, self-concept, all of those things get tied into your signaling commitment to a particular meta-narrative, then you're captured literally by the simulation of reality that's playing out on social media. And that's when you end up being able to not ground back in those original things. And of course, it's complicated, right? Because when socioeconomic structures and cultural patterns have already kind of like dissolved some of that life world, right? And then the social media comes in, it becomes very difficult. I say this in a sense from a place of privilege, where I've been able to be able to find a way to preserve my access to these givens. And I think it's possible for anyone, but there are definitely certain situations you can get into in our society where the chips are stacked against you, as it were. I don't know what the phrase is, something stacked against you, and you, and the opportunity to stay in touch and to stay grounded is few and far between. And so as an educator, this is my main focus. I'm not on getting people to know history or science, technology, engineering, math, or 21st century skills. No, fuck that, right? We need to return to the common source of the personhood and humanness, which have to do with these things that are part of the natural human makeup.
Yeah.
Right. But they've been as preyed upon and extracted for profit as any other part of the natural world. It's important stuff.
Yeah. And so I see two places we could go right now. One is in exploring how to revivify and preserve, protect these anthropological sort of awarenesses or perceptions, connections. And then there's also the conversation about, like, if that has been preserved, if that is grounded, then how do you participate in this kind of mimetic field of meta narratives and all that? And originally, before the pandemic, in my head, the conversation we're going to have was going to be a deeper dive into your meta psychology and meta ethics and kind of and I want to have that conversation actually very badly, both like personally and professionally. But I think that given the present moment, it's probably more useful for us to speak a little bit about how to engage in that meta narrative in a way that doesn't compromise our center, our commitments to those around us, but also feels, you know, for speaking personally, like virtuous and like I'm kind of doing the right thing, that I'm participating in a way that I can be proud of, and that doesn't just throw more bullshit on top of the bullshit pile, basically, a little bit pejoratively, but that seems to be what's going on right now. And so how ought one, you know, not like a public intellectual, except insofar as everybody is, how do we start to relate to participate in this space, this sphere of meta narrative?
It's a good question. Yeah. I mean, I think there's two distinct things here. One is, you know, back to the role of social media, right? And then the other is the kind of unique gifts and responsibilities that one has outside of social media. So when I hear your question, my first thought is that it's, and I know you're not asking this question, but it sounds like, how should I participate on social media responsibly? And I think that is a lot of actually the problem, is that to participate in the meta narrative, it seems like doing some kind of strange kind of like receiving advertisement and then purchasing a particular worldview and as if that is how you, so it's like you're voting with your social media about which worldview is correct. And then there's social pressure to get into one of these particular worldviews. But that's actually not really engaging with the meta narrative. That's engaging with social media. And if we say, well, what would it mean to engage with the meta narrative if you didn't engage in social media? It's a different question, because then it's about, back to the question I mentioned, what do you need to live? What do you need to know to live? Not what do you need to know to be able to signal correctly into social media so that you get the type of feedback you want to get from the people you want to get it from, but rather what do you actually need to orient given the unique range of responsibilities and obligations you have in your concrete life. Your concrete life, the people you see face to face and deal with and have hour-long conversations with, not the people you have asynchronous text-based exchange that are quasi-anonymous, right? And that's two distinct things. So for as long as we think, okay, participating in the meta-narrative is refining my activities on social media, we've asked the completely the wrong question. Because there's also this question of, like, why are you on social media? It's a deep, what are you actually doing? Especially when we know it was designed to capture our attention, right?
Yeah.
To commodify it. And therefore, because the thing that captures attention most is polarization, extremism, it was designed to polarize us and make us more extreme. And this is just the case. You have to look at Tristan Harris's work or any of the work of the people who've studied this seriously, let alone the people who are like whistleblowers within the industry saying like, well, I don't let my kids even touch this stuff. Like this is toxic.
Yeah.
We know that stuff. Right. So it's kind of like knowing cigarettes cause lung cancer and smoking anyway.
There's putting a bigger filter on the cigarette or something.
It's putting a bigger filter, but it's also just like, you know, there's a, you know, so what I'm saying is like, I want to answer that question about what do we need to know to live, to act with our unique responsibilities and obligations in our concrete life. Yeah. I'm not super concerned about what's the best, most responsible way to participate on social media. Because I, in fact, think that is a trick question because the medium is the message. Well, there is no way.
Well, and you know, folks like Daniel Schmachtenberger are continuing to participate on social media, and at least in his case, is kind of speaking on behalf of this message of like, it's uncertain.
Right.
We actually don't know what is going on. And he's doing a lot of work, I think, to kind of puncture people's certainty, which... I guess it's like... I don't know.
I keep telling Daniel to get the fuck off of social media. You know? And it's like, and he's having to block people, and he's having
to find
the conversation, and there's bots on there.
Yeah, it's just you're fighting such an uphill battle.
Yeah.
You're fighting, like, and it's funny because I don't usually feel any compulsion to kind of add my voice to the mix, but there is a very unique cultural moment right now where I do feel that way,
right.
Weirdly. Like, I feel like, oh, I should say something about the protests. I should say something.
Right. You should. But social media is not the only place to say something. You know? And
right, but I see how that impulse or that intention kind of rendered into the frame of social
media.
That's
what's so devious.
And then it would have been corrupted, actually. It has a high likelihood of being corrupted.
Yeah.
In all kinds of ways.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's kind of the most insidious, kind of almost disgusting thing about what's happened with social media is that the natural, again, anthropological impulse to communicate and to connect, right? And to speak one's truth and to receive truth, the things that make human culture go are now captured with advertisements next to them. And then you're not even clearly communicating because the news feed of your friend is not the news feed of you. And so there's all of these kind of like bubble creation, tunnel vision creation algorithms, right? And that's happening. We all know that that's happening. And yet we're still participating in social media as if it makes a difference that people get convinced and they don't. And this is the other issue. It's like teacherly authority is something I talk about a lot. And one of the biggest problems now is that we've had a complete collapse of teacherly authority. And when you're in a school system that's not working and you're a very reflective adolescent, you see teachers who are forced into very difficult positions and teachers who are not good. And you end up kind of like walking into a school and being cynical, skeptical of anything that's happening precisely because you're in school. So similarly with social media, the best, most curated, like Schmachtenberger, like post on social media, it's still on that platform. And it's just like walking into school and be like, oh, I'm in a school. Anything a teacher says is bullshit. When you're on social media, it's just one of those other things in your newsfeed. It's, you know, it's a very Marshall McLuhan-esque point just about the fact that the form of the media, the hidden curriculum of the structure of the media is more important than the content that's transmitted through it. And so this idea of how to engage responsibly with meta-narratives, how to actually engage with those responsibly, may, part of the answer to that question may be seriously either getting off social media or relating to it in a completely different way. And then reorienting to this question of what do I actually need to know to make good on my virtues and obligations and unique commitments within my concrete life. And then that becomes an actual sense-making project you can you can work on, you know? Like, oh, I live in this place. What's the actual situation with the virus in my city? Or what's the actual situation with the police in my city? And look into that, not by doing a bunch of headline scanning on social media and then getting trapped in arguments and down a rabbit hole, right? But actually looking at primary source materials, which are available on the internet. The internet is wonderful. And it's not just Facebook. If that's your doorway to the internet, you're screwed, right? But you can find statistics about how many cops are shooting people in your city. You can find statistics, you know, about other things that are relevant for what you need to know in your concrete life. And then you can also talk to the people around you. Like the highest octane sense-making stuff, as Jordan Hall said, is first-person experience. We think it's the big epidemiological studies, but it's like, no, talk to somebody. Right. Talk to a cop, right? Talk to a doctor from an emergency room, right? Talk to someone who's sick, right? To have those conversations and see what they do to you and how different that is than looking at two dozen headlines in 45 minutes on Facebook, right? Huge difference. And I end up landing hard on social media because I do think it's one of the key linchpins here that's basically driving us to a state of something like a mass psychotic break. And it, you know, it would be, if you think about the noosphere as a whole, and you think about like the development of the noosphere as this kind of large human mind, like the aggregate human mind, you think about it developing over centuries. And you think about the relative coherence and slowness of that pace. Like, think about the number of images circulating through the noosphere, the number of words circulating through the noosphere, and it's kind of evolving, and it starts to accelerate, and then you get past 1900 and it starts to accelerate, and you get pictures, and then you get movies, and all of a sudden you hit freaking 2000 or something around then, and it's like zonk, right? And if you saw that pattern in individual development, you're like, oh, that person's leading up to a psychotic break. Like, uncontrollable machinations of images and words and completely contradictory and incoherent things and new symbols emerging and old symbols being recited, all of that happening within like the equivalent of a finger snap. What it looks like, if you step back, you know, phylogenetically, big picture development of the noosphere, it looks like we're in the process of a psychotic break or an incredible mystical experience, right? So this is the other thing. It's like, we don't know what we're in the middle of. But we are in the middle of one of the most profound transformations a human species has ever gone through. You know, is it as big as like the move out of the Bronze Age, or as big as the move out of, you know, pre-modernity into modernity, like long 16th century? Or is it as big as like the emergence of life from matter, or multicellular organisms from single cellular organisms, or the cerebralization of things? And that is worth thinking about. So that massive, I think, obvious transformation that the noosphere is under right now, and we're all just plugged in. And you're plugged in whether you're on social media or not. That's what you have to get. That consciousness is not limited to the digitally mediated semiotic exchange. You end up having a lot of things going on, which you can't even detect. And again, your experience in retreat when you came out, you love these people. That's there. There's more love in the noosphere now than there's ever been. Much more subtle, more profound forms of love, precisely adjacent to these uniquely tragic forms of life that are emerging as well. So just the sheer complexity of the human experience is just like exponentiated. And so, yeah, you're confused for a reason.
Yeah, but you're helping me see how, like, I had this impulse to, like, want to be of service broadly, you know, in this conversation. And probably it's because I had more attention coming at me, so I felt like I could kind of do something good with it. But that was actually, in a sense, being hijacked into a medium that I can run a simulation of what would have happened right now.
Right.
And like, best case scenario isn't really that interesting. worst case scenario is quite bad for me and for probably and maybe my relationships with certain other people. But if instead I kind of release the capture that social media had over that impulse and sort of redirect it to like what's going down in Lowell, Vermont, what's happening in my community, how did they experience the last 2 months that I was on retreat, and what kind of emotional anguish are they still holding? And like,
and what do you need to know to act in that space?
Yeah.
You know, like what does the monastery need to know to remain a secure, safe place?
Yeah.
So there's a bunch of concrete questions you can ask about your immediate local situation. Some of them sometimes touch upon these complex meta-narratives,
right.
But some of them do not. And some of them are things we've known
totally
need to be done regardless.
Well, and this was the kind of where I was getting to. I think I said that I was interviewed actually by David Fuller after I got out of retreat. And what I was feeling was that, like, I love complex, abstract, meta conversations. Right. And the feeling I had coming out of retreat was that insofar as those conversations are not in service of me showing up completely and loving those that are around me and acting with integrity and virtue in that context, I'm not interested in them anymore. And I want to know what are the conversations that then are left that I can have and that I can share that will help me and help others to do that in a way that they can trust.
Right. Yeah. Now that's my feeling, friend. It's been my feeling for a long time.
I think there's a kind of shaving away of some of more ways that I personally got confused, like thinking that certain conversations might be useful, but in fact they were not.
Right.
Looking back on it, I can kind of see that.
Yeah, and there is a tendency, and again, I think it's from the forms of schooling that we participated in so much, there's a tendency to think that sense-making is about getting the right or most sophisticated answer on some abstract linguistic test, but it's actually not. The proof of the pudding is actually in some kind of something like embodied wisdom or embodied capacity for love, something like that. That's the proof in the pudding. You're doing good sense-making. If you can do that. Now, depending on who you are, that's very complicated. If you've gotten yourself into a position where your influence is very large, or you are in a very complicated field that has a lot of responsibilities, then your task is very complex. But even someone who is in a situation of relative greater simplicity still faces the full complexity of the human condition. And needing to act. And so that's a great way to think about it. It's like, does this conversation actually help me in my embodied relationship with other people? And that's a very good litmus test. And then what happens then is then things become much, much simpler.
Yeah.
And the things you pay attention to become fewer and probably deeper.
Yeah. I can't help though, like what comes up as I hear this, like there's a part of me that's like, okay, well then I should just completely get off of social media.
I think so. that's what I'm recommending. And there's a few people who are saying that, there's a book out by that.
But I can't help feel like I'm abandoning.
Of course.
There's like a collective discourse or the collective in some vague sense.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's what's so interesting about the quandary is that there is a sense that this thing which we know, again, the evidence is there, is bad for us, like psychologically and culturally, like addiction, dysphoria, depression, anxiety, adolescent suicide, a whole bunch of things we know this product does. We understand this product is somehow a civic duty to participate in. Right, it would be like, okay, do your civic duty, smoke cigarettes. Do your civic duty, eat McDonald's.
Mm.
Right, those things people still do, smoking cigarettes and eating McDonald's, but they do them knowing that this is something that's actually potentially borderline irresponsible to do, depending on the commitments you have, people needing you to be healthy.
Right.
So, but we're in a quandary with social media where we know this thing is bad for us, and yet we have convinced ourselves that it's our social obligation to continue to participate in it. Mm. And from an advertising perspective, it's like, if I was running Facebook, that's exactly what I would want you to think. I would want you to think there's actually no way to be a responsible person unless you are really using Facebook in a very, day-to-day kind of like a complicated way. If you're not doing that, then you're out of touch, you're irresponsible, you're in a shell, you're living in a cave, et cetera, right? Right. And I can speak from experience, having not been on Facebook for 6 years now, maybe even a little longer, not true. I definitely feel extremely engaged, and I don't feel out of touch. In fact, I'm in more conversations with people than I might otherwise would be as part of my sense-making. And then I'm also engaging with the internet in a very different way without the kind of Facebook as my gate to entry and like relevance indicator. So there's a bunch of things that shift. Now I'm not suggesting people check out entirely of trying to make sense of the broader world. But those are not synonymous with Facebook. Right. And you could even argue that it's the obverse. Right. Like if you spend time, the same time you would spend on Facebook, you spend that time reading long-form articles by the best possible journalists from across the political spectrum, my guess would be you'd be better informed about the world than you would be if you were spending that time scrolling through social media and participating in arguments there. This is my guess. Now, would there be some things you might not see that you wouldn't otherwise see? It's possible. But some of the things that you wouldn't see, you maybe don't actually want to have seen. Right? So the other thing to remember is that we know, again, the evidence is there, that social media is used strategically to perform things basically best considered to be unconventional warfare. These are taken by state actors that are not the United States, political parties within the United States, and advertisers. And so that's important to remember, too, which is that, there is a way that Facebook is actually a dangerous place to be from the perspective of as a society being strategically thrown into incoherence by unconventional warfare experts from other countries. Mm. And so, again, we just know that this is the case, but we still participate on there and don't realize that. And I forget the exact statistic, but in 2016, it was something like 50 to 70% of the communications people were in were with bots. It was a very large percentage. But even if it's 10%, you're still arguing with a goddamn robot, thinking that you're like protecting the truth, right? When you're actually being manipulated by someone with asymmetric power over you, meaning they know all about all your clicks for every website you've ever been through for the past 4 weeks or more. And so they're going to use that information, more information than you have about yourself. You don't remember all that stuff. They're going to use that to target a particular advertisement or particular engagement with you. And so again, it's like, I sound like this is like a Facebook conspiracy theory, but this is known. Yeah. We've known this. And people are like sharing this on Facebook.
Totally. Well, and that's most of where I get my information about how bad Facebook is through Facebook.
This is what I'm saying. So the more you think about it, and the farther you are from it, and the more you, like, this is some of my advantage, is that I'm not in it. So when you look at it from a distance, it's like, oh, okay.
Well, and I'm realizing, one, I think that for me, and I think for other people who are participating in the kind of media ecology that I am in, there is a kind of, I'm recognizing like a kind of arrogance in the way that we use these surfaces, thinking that we are immune because we have a kind of meta perspective on them.
Right.
But that's not actually true, because when I got off retreat and I started using social media again, I could see in very fine detail the way it both hijacked my nervous system as well as my mind, I got more confused. I got more anxious. And more alienated, as I mentioned, from the community that I actually live with. And so coming out of retreat, I didn't, quote unquote, live through it, but there seems to be an amplification of the incoherence taking place in social media. And I appreciate your like looking at that and saying, oh, it might be headed for a psychological break. That seems...
Yeah. No, I'm saying we're in it.
We're in the psychological
we're
break
in
right
the
now.
Psychological
this
break.
Is the psychological
or the
break.
Crazy mystical experience remains to be seen. Huh. But it happened. It happened
oh, really?
Probably in 2016. And I've written about this. I mean,
whoa.
And so, yeah, that's my sense. We're in it. That's the way to relate to the culture now is like you're talking to a schizophrenic person on the street. That's the way to relate to the culture. You know, sometimes a schizophrenic person says something and you're like, that's the deepest shit I've ever heard. And sometimes a schizophrenic person says something where you're like, I'm scared now. I'm going to try to get away from you because maybe you're dangerous. That's the state of the culture, basically, as far as I can tell. Now, that doesn't mean that people within the culture individually are having psychological breaks, although that is actually happening at a higher and higher rate. Mm. But it does mean, on the whole, the noosphere itself, taken as a whole, is in that process. And so that's why it feels so kind of scary, that sense of how can we stop this and what's going to happen next kind of feeling that we're having is that sense of this thing is out of control. It's under its own volition. And, you know, Harry Stack Sullivan, one of the great, relatively unknown psychologists, American psychologist, had incredible success rates with dealing with psychosis. And it involved not prematurely or at all stopping the break, but allowing it to run its course basically in a safe, contained environment, right? Because right now, the typical way to deal with psychic breaks like this is hospitalization and drugging and maybe even electric shock, which stops a process that's initiating from any kind of completion and like interrupts it drastically. Mm. And success rates for that kind of work are bad. People come back repeatedly. They never get out of it. Whereas Harry Stack Sullivan, and this used to happen basically before widespread use of psychiatric medication and certain forms of institutionalization, someone would have a psychotic break at a certain period in their life, and they would move through this complex multi-month process, and they would come out the other end, and they wouldn't have a return to those problems ever again in their life. Mm. Right? And so this sounds controversial because the narrative we're told now is that this isn't the case. But if you look at Robert Whittaker's work, and again, Harry Stack Sullivan's work, you find that actually this is pretty well documented. It doesn't mean that there aren't cases where that person will always struggle the rest of their life. But it does mean that there can be certain organic, necessary processes for radical identity change, which are incredibly painful and potentially incredibly dangerous. But if they're able to run their natural course as opposed to being stopped short, right? And so the concern we have now, the fear of authoritarianism or totalitarianism from either side of the political spectrum, the fear that we have of that is that basically we're going to get so nuts that there's going to be a clampdown right, to stop the insanity. And it will be a forceful, basically premature resolution to what needed to be a full unraveling and a full kind of like emergence of all of this psychical phenomenon and all of the trauma and all like that needs to happen, right? Oof. But how do we even do that in a safe way? I mean, there's a lot of complicated questions, but I do know that clamping down with authoritarianism, those kinds of moves, we can feel that on the edges waiting to happen. And that's, I think, some of what is in the air is a sense of, you know, oh my God, make the craziness
make it stop.
Stop. Make it stop. Make it stop. But we can't. If we make it stop, that'll be the worst possible thing. We actually need to go in and through, down and in, and somehow pop out.
But you're making a subtle point here, because on the one hand, don't try to stop it, and also extricate yourself from its day-to-day machinations.
Right. So it's like I'm saying I'm talking about the noosphere.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the totality of the culture.
Yeah. Right?
And so there's this question of during a psychotic break, right, as it starts to restabilize, which of those thoughts, right, which are the nodes in the network that just spun out of control that become the new central nodes of coherence around which the new identity congeals, right? So there's this question of, if enough people start to actually pull out, right? And really orient in a different way and pull together a certain kind of like critical mass of coherence and sanity, that becomes the seed from which it can propagate out broader arrays of coherence. So it's part of the strategy, actually, is saying like, yeah, you know, there's going to be some crazy shit going on. The degree to which you get completely caught up and swept away in that stuff, it's like putting fuel on the fire or bullshit on the bullshit pile. But if you start making other piles of like, you know, nutritious things or something, I don't know what the right metaphor is, then those
virtue piles.
Yeah, then eventually it's like Leslie Combs, who is a psychologist, and he applied chaos theory to psychological dynamics, and he showed that you actually get these attractor basins within the psyche. So now we're in this kind of psychotic attractor basin, but we can create another attractor basin. This language is kind of being used in various places in like the game B world and stuff, but there is another attractor basin that can be created that will eventually pull energy from that one. But right now we feel like there's actually a responsibility to go act as if that stuff's not crazy when we know goddamn well it's crazy.